outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of Bravada's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey. The God Journey. The God Journey.
Well, it was a glorious walk in the snow, Kyle. I got up the last day. We were with my dad. Sarah and I went up to visit my dad for the first time since August, so it's been a while. And we had plans to go earlier, but various things sidetracked it. So last morning, it had snowed 2 inches, and it was a little cold and slippery for Sarah to go out and walk. So I went out and took the dogs alone. And I'm telling you what, when you got 2 inches of fresh powder, and you're the first person that traverses these roads, there haven't been cars down these roads yet. Man, all the deer tracks and bear tracks and coyote tracks. I don't know what tracks I was looking at, but it was fascinating. Just some running, some just sauntering. Didn't see it. Didn't see an animal at all. But I mean, I tell you, I don't live in it, so I get to see it once a season. And for those of you that are sick of the snow back east, I get it. I'm sorry. But I tell you what, I found it to be a glorious morning just walking in the snow with my pups.
Some of my favorite walks have been after a fresh snow in the mountains or on one of our ranches and just seeing, you know, seeing the animal footprints. And there's something about how snow is like the mighty eraser,
yes,
right? It just kind of covers over all the imperfections. And it's like this blank slate of beauty that is untouched. And there's something very freeing about that, something very peaceful about it.
There is, even when it covers up some of that fire scar that was left up there. It's the first time we've been up there since that big fire. And even though it wasn't exactly near my dad's place or where we are, we're driving through it and you're seeing it. And when the snow covers it, I mean, yeah, you can tell there's no pine needles on those stumps that are left, but yeah, it does give it a tranquil kind of beauty to it, even as it's going to have to recover now from something pretty devastating. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
I want to welcome you to this edition of The God Journey, and what a crazy week it has been. My friend Lewis debuted today. I'm really excited about that. And help from Blue Sheet Media and getting that thing out and ready to go. And just the early returns from people just saying, well, this is one compelling story. I know we played the first episode last week on The God Journey, so some of you may have already heard that. That's all that's dropped so far on the podcast, on the website. So don't run over to my friend Lewis thinking you're going to get episode 2. Not till next Tuesday. But real excited about that story finally getting the world. But that's been a crazy last few weeks, getting the website redesigned at The God Journey kind of was the same time as overlapping the my friend Lewis thing. And oh my gosh, what a crazy, crazy time it's been. But I'm really happy. Both those things just makes my heart happy.
I cannot wait for people to be able to get to enjoy the story of my friend Lewis. Like, those podcast episodes are so good. My experience of going through it was just, I mean, every single episode, I'm like, wait, that's where they're stopping it? That's where they're going to leave it? And I've been able to listen to 5 of them. Sorry, listeners.
Whoa, don't let that out.
5 of them.
Yeah.
I've got to preview 5 of them at least.
Thank you.
And man, it's just so good. So, so good. And yet I still find myself shaking my head. And I'm like, okay, really? Like, really, Lewis? Like, did that actually happen? Like, okay, you know. Oh, it's such a rich story. Oh my gosh.
It is an amazing story. And I've asked him that a few hundred times myself as we're talking through it and he's telling me the story and then I'll get done and we'll go down and we'll sit and talk. And I go, you just got to tell me, man, this stuff's really happened. You haven't confused your dreams with the real world. And yeah, I've really drilled down on this. And knowing what I know about Lewis and knowing even some of the spectacular things that happened in his childhood when he was unaware of it being God behind it, those things continue into life today. So, I mean, I see those things unfold in his life in a weekly kind of daily way. So I know there's a reality to that that's profound. And I think it will help build people's faith as well as give them some stuff to struggle with, which I think is all fun. The last 2 weeks, I've hosted kind of a Zoom session, open Zoom sessions, one off live stream page, dealing with some of the political climate and people dealing with relatives and friends that they're kind of poles apart with. And then out of that one came up the idea, could we talk about race again? Can we talk about how to be involved in a discussion about race that doesn't have to go sideways? And so I asked Arnita, she joined us Sunday. That's recorded. You can go to the God Journey Facebook page and you can watch that whole hour-long thing if you want to. May take some excerpts of it at some point because there were some wonderful lessons in that. And I heard back from a lot of people that said, wow, that was almost miraculous in the way we navigate a discussion. I mean, it's kind of, you got a room full of people that don't know each other And yet some very profound things showed up. One was very interesting. My friend Jerome from South Carolina, a question was asked of the group, why, when you look at the insurrection that happened in the Capitol on January 6th, do you see no people of color there? Why are they all white? Hmm. Which is not a thought I've had. I don't think about that. And some of the initial response is, and then the feeling is, if that was, can you imagine if that was a black mob that had showed up at the Capitol? Hmm. Would the police have handled it differently? Would the Capitol police have done something different? Would there have been quicker to go to arms? And the concern from people in that community is, it would have been a completely different reality. And obviously we don't know, but I would share that high probability. My thought was, because most Trump followers seem to be the whole MAGA thing, the Make America Great Again, for a lot of people I know, harkens back to the 50s, early 60s, when America was more homogenous, more Christian, more, I don't think it's about whiteness so much, but they just think about, man, the morality was somewhat more consistent. Our society seemed to be less at war with each other. It was a peaceful time, and you know, our kids were in schools, and we didn't have to worry about what the school was trying to teach our kids. And so when you say Make America Great Again to that group, it mostly becomes a white attraction. Because if you were a person of color back in the 50s, you're not hearkening back to, oh, yeah, that's a great time. Let's go back to Make America Great Again. And I know I've heard this from a lot of Trump supporters. That's not what they think of by Make America Great Again. They think more of the downgrading of the military. They think more of things like that. But there was, particularly in the people of color that I know, blacks and browns were saying to me, it sounded like dog whistling to a white audience. And there have been kind of a lot of white supremacist groups that have found some affiliation with the things Trump was saying and doing. So whether he's meaning to do that or not, it is nonetheless at the same recourse. But one of the guys in the room, Jerome, a friend of mine, just said, you know what, as a black man, I don't know where I would ever feel the right to walk into the Capitol and demand my way of the leaders of this country. And I'm going, yeah, I get that. Nothing in his heritage, nothing in his anything says we would have a right to do that.
Yeah.
And was he saying it? I'm thinking, I wouldn't either. I have nothing in my past that says, yeah, I have a right to storm into Congress and demand an outcome to an election that I wasn't happy with, or even if I felt it was stolen or whatever. I don't feel like I had that either, but especially people of color, African-Americans would definitely be able to say, yeah, we don't have that. And then someone else used the word entitlement. Hmm. Whether you feel entitled in the culture. And I think that does play into a whiter crowd. It's not necessarily a racial thing. So we talked about some of that, which I thought was really fabulous. One of the things Arnita said, which I know this will tick some people off, she said what people, and a lot of people do because of the book, they want to talk to her, particularly white people, want to talk to her about various things about race. And when they start asking, you know, kind of her perspective, she said the first question she asks is, tell me how you steward your privilege.
Mm. Ooh, that's good.
And she said, I can tell right then that their response to that question tells me whether or not we can have a conversation.
Ooh, okay.
Because if they don't realize they have it and they're not even thinking about how I steward it, then they're not ready for a conversation about race with me. Because there does need to be some reshaping of how we with lighter colored skin respond to the process. And I thought, what a great question.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that it expands beyond even just race too. You know, especially, so for example, being a millennial, that's been one of the critiques of our generation, is that we come across as very entitled. Mm-hmm. And that we, like, for example, we expect to be able to graduate from college with a 4-year bachelor's degree, go straight into an executive level position.
High paying career.
Yeah. Get 6 figures, work a 40.
With my French art degree.
Yes, exactly. My French literature degree, you know, that's just for us being us, that's what we're owed or entitled to. I love that question because that really gives me pause. I've definitely thought about what privileges I've had being Caucasian, being from the family that I've had, being from the geographical region that I've had. But in regards to what does it look like to actively steward that and to use that for the better, to acknowledge it, but then also move forward for the betterment of my community and the people that are around me? And what does that process look like? But I don't know if I've ever verbalized that, of how am I actively stewarding my entitlement.
Or the privilege is what she said.
Or privilege, sorry. Privilege.
Yeah, because one of the things that one lady said about, she wrote me this later after the conversation, and this statement is so powerful. She said, whenever you're entitled, you're going to find yourself holding title to a whole world of pain. Mm. I love that. Mm. Whenever you feel entitled, whether it's with God, with your spouse, with your friends, you feel entitled to a certain outcome, you are holding title to a world. I love that play on entitlement, and now you have title to a world of pain. That's from Joni. I really love that. But the idea of privilege, and I think what I love about this, most people who look like me have a hard time talking about white privilege. They want to dismiss it. They want to just say, yeah, no, I just want the whole world to be colorblind. Doesn't matter what color your skin, it's the content of your character and all that stuff. And I think people of color now see that as a way to avoid the realities that they face every day. It may be true in your world, you can pretend everybody's the same color and you don't treat them differently, but they know they get treated differently in the world. And what I like about how are you stewarding your privilege, it's not how are you feeling guilty, how are you feeling like a horrible white European, no good for nothing, shameful, you know, colonizer. It just says you have it. How are you stewarding it? Are you stewarding it in a way that grants access to other people? Are you stewarding, which I think mirrors the heart of Jesus when he said, to whom much has been given, much has been expected.
Yeah.
And I also know those who feel like, well, you know, maybe they are Caucasian, but they've grown up very poor and life treated them very harshly. And they say, I don't feel privileged at all. And I realize there's truth in that. Not every person, but, and I'm reading a book now called Caste, which is... Hmm. It's an interesting depiction, because what I like is it kind of blows up the race thing, where it's not just about race. It's about the stratas in our society between the caste system, and saying we have a caste system in America, from the celebrity, power, elite, entitled group to the middle class to people of color, that there is a caste system that's not completely racial. The overlay is not automatically racial, but it does dovetail with race. And I'm just finding, again, when I read books like this, I don't find every, I know people then yell at me, why would you do a book like that? I've heard something bad about that book. Well, I heard stuff bad about The Shack too, and I still read it, worked on it. So go ahead and do that. But I read it because I really want to say, wow, there's some real power to our thinking of the caste nature of the culture we live in. And it's amazing to me how political leaders, both sides of the parties, get their constituency to support stuff that 90% of the time benefits the elites, not the common person, mm-hmm. whether it's tax cuts or tax raises and giving money away. It's not about power for the average person. Entitlements from the government are always about power of government over people's lives. And we willingly give it to them. And we willingly, you know, the tax cuts are always disproportionately beneficial to the rich. And it's amazing how many people I know who are lower class, middle class, support those because that's the ideology. And it's an amazing thing. I've enjoyed stepping back going, wow, how much of a caste system, I mean, I've seen it in India where it's just absolutely mm-hmm. despicable. It's more subtle in our culture, but it nonetheless exists. And nepotism thrives there. You're born into a certain caste and... Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, celebrities, children get an added bonus every way you can get access and, you know, all that stuff. And then we go celebrate. I mean, they have parties like the Academy Awards where we go and look at the entitled people and applaud them and think how great and awesome they are. And just going, wow, this whole thing really infiltrates who we are.
Man, I haven't even thought about that. Probably not since when we were studying the caste system back in high school. I've always struggled with that because, especially like with the Academy Awards or some of those things where, you know, where millions of people are watching on TV an elitist audience or elitist crowd of people or constituency of people that are all celebrating the victories that made them more elite. Like
they fawn over themselves. Yeah. It's not even that they, some of you are good actors. You produced a good movie. It was great. It was interesting.
Absolutely.
The connection between audience and celebrity is weird because they feel like those are their friends. That's my I'm one of them. And you're not. But no. You'll go there and it'd be like taking all the kids in high school who were not the most likely to succeed, best quarterback. It'd be like those guys having a party and the rest of us get to sit around and watch it and go, oh yeah, yay for you. Look how great you are. You're amazing. And yet we do.
I feel like that's what we're okay with. We've almost settled for, well, at least I get to glimpse into their lives and get to share,
Vicarious attachment?
Vicarious, yeah. Thank you. Share vicariously through watching on a TV screen. Well, at least I get a snippet of their life and a snippet of their world, and I can celebrate with them together and feel like I'm a part of it. But isn't that the same with professional sports?
Absolutely.
Right? Like we're looking at this
except for the Green Bay Packers, of course. But
oh, okay,
other,
right.
Other teams.
I wasn't
yeah.
going to mention
other
them.
Teams.
I wasn't going to mention them.
Jump all over them.
You know, it's you know, especially watching people get so intense about, you know, their athletic team or how they do, and they're distraught if their athletic team doesn't do well. I live very close to the border of probably one of the most passionate states for their college football team in the nation. You know, I literally work in Nebraska. So I tip my toe into the water of the Nebraska cult of the Cornhuskers.
And they've had some tough years of late.
Oh man.
They can't be a happy group.
We're still holding on to the 90s, you know, hoping that someday those glory days will come back. And yet it's like this longing to be able to, at least if I can't live a life like that, and if I can never have access to that kind of joy or that kind of life experience, at least I can feel like I'm a part of it by watching it from a distance.
Yeah. And how easily, particularly in professional sports, when that guy over there who's got no character and just mean and nasty, I get to hate him. And then as soon as my team gets him on their squad and puts their laundry on him, suddenly he's the greatest person, basketball player, football. We love him. He's great. He's on our side now. And that's a wash for everything.
Absolutely.
Well, after the first conversation, I got this email from Pam and I thought, man, this is, we've talked about some of this. I've written about some of this in terms of what some people are feeling, but I want to read this email because I think it's really got some things that will help us to think about. Because one of the things I shared in the conversation is how hopeful I'm feeling right now. I really have a sense of God's hand in the things that are going on. And even though when you look at it at a human level, it's depressing, it's scary, it's weird, it's all that. But boy, when you see what God's, and I don't know what God's doing in terms of I have an outcome here, but I see a God who is at work, even in the frustrations and failures of humanity. But she says, I don't know why you're so hopeful. I don't feel hopeful at all. I would like to feel that, but truthfully, I have felt heaviness and sorrow for months. I weep often and find myself apologizing to God, feeling so sorry for the things so many who claim his name do in his name. I've often wondered how followers of Christ could have been persuaded to join the atrocity of the Crusades. All the things I watch unfolding today help me see how the fear factor you mentioned is powerful enough to make evil appear righteous. And she gives a couple of examples. I have family and friends who fall on all ranges of the political spectrum. Precious people, family members, and leaders in ministry, some who raged against Trump and said they were praying for him to be assassinated, and others holding out embarrassingly for the Red Sea miracle of God that was going to overturn the election and keep Trump in power. I know these people love Jesus. I know they want his kingdom to flourish. I know they're educated people, smart people. How could they get sucked into these things that keep them in a state of infuriation? I'm beginning to discover that it is our sore spots, those places of prior pain, where fear gains a foothold. It is almost as if people need these things to be true because it supports a more foundational worldview. One brother lives with terrible anxiety and has been predicting for 20 years, this is the year Jesus is coming back. And he's always wrong and changes it for the year to come. He needs to believe that the coronavirus vaccines are vehicles for the Antichrist to inject tracking mechanism in us because it means the rapture is close. One sister has some deep-seated fear, which has lured her to embrace the teaching of Seven Mountains, which is we as Christians get to rule over the planet by petitioning God in the courtroom of heaven and open portals with praise and worship through which God may access earth. Their them versus us story resonates as true to her with them being controlled by Satan. She needs that to be true because she needs to believe that we have great power to defeat darkness by decreeing the judgments of God. I really like how she makes that correlation between some pain in our life that produces a fear, and then we need to find the narrative, the story, and believe the story that most satiates that fear, and gives us some sense of comfort, even if it's a false comfort. You think about, you know, convinced this is the year Jesus is coming 20 years in a row, and the frustration, well, it's not, it's got to be this year. And that's your out. That, and until that happens, you haven't got a place to park your fear. And I think that's so true, how fear, I mean, I've watched it since I started doing bridge builder work back in the 80s. I have seen how much of the fundraising tactic of every group, whether it's Christian charities to political advocacy groups to political parties, you raise funds in America by raising fears. I also know how much the media, particularly cable channels, gain audience share and sell product when they keep their audience in fear. Fear of children being kidnapped, fear of school shootings, fear of kids going to a bar and being shot, fear of that. There's been this concerted attempt by so many people in our world, not because they want people to be afraid, but they benefit from fear. So we've been talking about this. Unfortunately, we've only talked about this in sketchy terms. People keep asking me, where did you and Kyle talk about the fear, fight, flight, freeze thing? And I'm going, I don't know. Because we've never really taken a whole podcast to really explore this idea that just recently come to my attention that you've maybe known about for a while, but how we process religious thought and political thought in the amygdala part of our brain. That's scientists basically say that's where it resides. So when you're thinking religious or political thoughts, your amygdala lights up in whatever scanning MRI they're using. Mm-hmm. And the amygdala is the more primitive part of the brain. They call it the reptile brain sometimes because it, you know, that cycle of things. But it's where fear reigns and where tribal identity is one of the ways we address the fear. I've got to be in the right tribe. Our tribe has to be right. And we have to win no matter what the cost, because that's the only way to deal with my fear. And I like the idea that fear manifests itself in one of three ways. We either fight it, fight back at what's coming at us so that we don't have to be afraid anymore. We run from it. We flee. And the other one is just we freeze. We just don't know what to do, so we just shut down or we go hide somewhere. Mm-hmm. Fight, flight, or freeze is a response to fear. And one of the things I was thinking about this morning as I was walking and just talking to God about some of these things, and I'll ask you the question, I guess. Have you ever chosen fear in your life?
Ooh. Oh, okay.
Isn't that a weird thought?
That is a weird thought.
Because we don't. I'd never have. I look back and go, you know, when I've been afraid, it's a reaction to things going on in which I feel insecure or at threat. I don't choose like, oh, here comes a circumstance. I think I will fear this one. I've never made that choice.
I think I would say this is an interesting idea. And man, I'm sitting here processing it. The first place that my mind goes is the victim mentality. So there's those people who either have had like a significant trauma in their life, or, you know, there's been abuse situation, or they've experienced fear in a very, very deep way. And so then instead of recognizing that fear, and instead of working through it, instead of owning their own place in that fear, it's safer for them to push that fear externally and say, no, that's like, the whole world is against me. I have a right to behave the way that I'm behaving. I have a right to fear the way that I'm fearing. I have a right to treat people the way that I'm treating them, because the whole world is out to get me. That I've experienced this fear from here, and I've experienced this emotion, this experience of fear from this direction, and it's justified my ability or my willingness to be able to behave in X, Y, and Z way. Because you're absolutely right. And in regards to the fight, flight, or freeze, and the other term for the freeze is hide, the fight, flight, or hide. That developmentally, we see this thing coming, and it's a survival technique of, okay, I'm going to either fight that for my survival, I'm going to run away from that for my survival, or I'm going to hide from that for my survival. And you see it, I mean, in animals, and my supervisor and I were actually just talking about this morning. There's actually a model in early childhood psychology about developmentally how people move through
You've had a long day at work.
I have had a long day at work.
you get to blank.
But it's walking through where people respond as far as fight, flight, or freeze. So for example, when kids are really young, they tend to freeze or they tend to hide because they don't feel like they have the ability to run away from it, and they don't feel like they have the ability to fight back. And then as people get older, they see a shift in the way that people respond to the fight, flight, or freeze. However, people who get stuck in that deep, into that repetitive fight, flight, or freeze at an early age, they tend to naturally go back to that earlier freeze or that earlier hide. And part of it too is what has been modeled for them that works. So for example, I challenged her on it because she said, well, you know, for the most part, little kids freeze when they're angry or blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I've had to go into classrooms and restrain first graders that were attacking their teacher with a pair of scissors out of anger, because that was amygdala response of, this person is causing me to go into that reptile brain where it's all about my survival. And so I'm going to attack this teacher or this parent or this peer with a weapon so that I can eliminate the threat. The interesting part about it is that our identities, when we process our identity from that space, so for example, religion or our political views, then it's going right past that prefrontal cortex where we're able to do relationship, we're able to have empathy, we're able to do perspective taking where we can see the other person's perspective and where they're coming from. All of that goes offline. And I mean, you can see it in the way that people respond. Like even today, I was working with some students and there was some situations that were coming up. And my supervisor was challenging me, Kyle, what is your response to that situation? When your amygdala gets triggered, what is your natural response? And like for me, it was never safe to fight. Like I could never fight because it would end up really, really bad for me. And I couldn't run because I'd get turned back in. And so then the punishment would be even worse. And so it was this freeze. It was this disengage. It was hide. It was go internal. And that same thing has been happening when I've been working with these kids that have significant emotional and mental health disturbances. I find myself freezing, or I find myself hiding or disengaging from that. And, you know, just watching our world around us in this fight, flight, or freeze response. And it's like, how did we as a culture get on a national level that we are responding out of the amygdala? How did we get to this place where the fear has been triggered so much nationwide in a vast majority of the population, to where the general feeling is hopelessness? The general feeling is not joy. The general feeling is fear.
Well, you look at the fundraising letters or the political rhetoric on both sides. Mm-hmm. It's filled with fear, which one of the things that really was shocking to me when Bob had that vision about politics and religion, these spirits wrestling together or dancing together. That why would those two be, and both those things, because they're fear-based. Religion is primarily a fear-based experience. Fear of hell, fear of missing out on God's blessings, fear of not doing enough, fear of disapproval of others. There's just so much fear that's attached to religion that it's no wonder that those things have found their way to each other, so that we're wired in that same way. It's made me really grateful that about 25 years ago, God began to invite Sarah and I out of a more fear-based relationship with God and more of an affection-based one, because it has shaped my ability to respond differently. When I first heard this thing, and I you know, fear, fight, or freeze is a natural thing God's given us, because if you're in a threatening situation, that's how you need to take care of it, right?
Yep.
I said, I don't choose fear. When Sarah woke me up, I'm first about fourth year marriage, Sarah woke me up in the middle of the night. I could tell all was not well in the world. And she's sitting straight up in bed. And I looked at her and I said, it's like 3 a.m. I said, what's the matter? There's someone in our front room. I mean, she didn't say it like, I think there is. There's someone in our front room. And I'm telling you what, all the amygdala stuff, baby, it kicks in, because I need that. I go from a dead sleep to hyper alert to, how am I going to handle this? Barricade myself in the bedroom, or am I going to go out there in my underwear and take on somebody? Because I'm thinking somebody's in my front room.
Yeah.
And so I start down the hallway. You're screaming, you know, what are you doing? What do you want? And I'm coming down the hallway, and I haven't got anything. Since then, I've slept with a nice club under my bed, because I don't want to walk down the hallway with nothing again. I want something. Fortunately, no one was there. Somebody had thrown a rock through our window and had found the rock and a torn curtain, but no one was actually there. And then it takes a while, right, for all that.
Oh, yeah.
Or like you're driving down the road and somebody cuts you off or does something really dangerous. All of a sudden, all that fight, flight, whatever, and sometimes anger at you, moron, is coming out of all of that. So we're not sitting here saying fear is a bad thing. Fear can be a good thing, but prolonged fear of an imaginary enemy is the thing that's killing us. It's caused us to process such a polarized environment, because like you say, when you, even in the discussions we've had on recent Sundays, having empathy for the other, whether it's politically, racially, whatever, when you're afraid that you're not going to have enough for you, and you've lived so long, you wouldn't even call it fear anymore. You live so long in the shadow of this intense need to defend, protect, grab, fight against people who are trying to take my rights away. When you live in that, then you're, and I love this. I think I love this about Scripture. Scripture always says, continues to put, when you live out of fear, you're going to miss the best stuff God's doing. That's why, even with him, don't be afraid, because God shows up in the Old Testament, even in the New Testament, and people are terrified. He goes, don't be afraid. Yeah. Fear is not going to help you spiritually. It may help you survive in a critical situation, but it really needs to be somewhat short term. It's the prolonged fear that I think, whether it's prolonged at God religiously, whether it's prolonged at humanity because they're the other, is killing us as a culture. I love that God, I thought it was about different ways of doing church 25 years ago. And it really was a different way of living, to live inside of God's affection. And then when fear hits, I say, God, what are you doing here? My heart goes to that. And I still, if I'm here, if Sarah says there's somebody in our front room tonight, I promise you, I'm coming down the stairs on full alert with it's a shovel handle, actually, in my hand. It's shortened because I'm not going to swing a full shovel. But I'm coming down to check out what it is and to see what it is and to deal with what it is, because I'm going to protect my family. But in these other kinds of experiences, what you were keep talking about, the prefrontal cortex, when I was hearing all this stuff about fear and religion and politics, where does the brain process faith? Because I don't think it comes from the brain. I think it comes from the heart, which is not the physical heart, but it comes from a different part of our being that may be nestled in the brain. I don't know where it's nestled. But when I come at it, what is it that affection allows me to think now that I didn't used to think before? And that's what has been, whether it's my friend Lewis and my relationship to someone who's in the country illegally, whether it's my relationship to Arnita and people saying things about color that I don't want to be true. I want to believe we're past that. Our society really is treating everyone fairly. And then to realize, oh, no, it's not. And then, do I have a responsibility in that? Do I have something that I can give that? Not beat me up with, and that's, I think, what many of my friends, when I try to talk about race and they get real neurotic, is they'll go to the excesses of Black Lives Matter as an organization. They'll go to, you know, this white fragility and feeling, and they just want me to feel guilty about my, no, they don't. Most of them don't. There are groups that do, yes. But most groups want to say, can we work at equity here? I don't want to send my kids in the world and be more afraid than you are when you send your kids into the world, that some engagement's going to go awry. And to me, the compassion that God began to work in Sarah and I 25 years ago and over the last 25 years allows me to access all of those things in my life very differently, for which I am incredibly grateful. Because faith, whenever I looked up faith, where's the brain process? It always took me back to the amygdala, because sociologists see faith as religion,
yep.
right?
Yep.
I don't. I see faith as very different from religious practice. I see faith having in mind transcendence, mm-hmm. empathy, compassion. It's those kinds of things that then, as you said, it's in the prefrontal cortex. You're going to do a paper on this someday. I hope it's out by the time we get this done, because I'd like people to read it, about how to process those differences. Because if you live your life out of fear all the time, you're not going to be making the best decisions, whether it's left fear or right fear. I'm not talking about one or the other. I'm talking about both. And we're getting a steady diet of that every day in our culture, to be afraid. And the enemy, he loves to add to our fear factor, because when we're afraid, we're not sensitive to what God's doing or not even aware of what he's about. It has been transformative for me. I have loved talking about this with you and exploring it in some of my reading to go, well, I want to get a real handle on this. And that's why it's so important that we help people find an affection based relationship with the Creator. That's what he wanted. He didn't want people afraid when he showed up. That's why the cross, so we can with confidence come boldly before the throne of grace. I mean, everything God did was to get us out of that fear mode with him. Get inside. I'm on your side. I love you. I'm with you in these things. I don't want to be.
And yet, like, you made the, I loved your question about, have you ever chosen fear? Because I think that we do. You know, I think that we often, especially as a culture right now, we are choosing fear. That's what we're choosing to invest our time in. That's what we're choosing to invest our clicks on. That's what we're, you know, our emotional energy is going to that.
Do we choose it, or is that just the way we react to the input we're getting? That's what I think. I don't know that I've ever chosen it.
But
that's true of most of my sins. Yeah. You know what I mean? I don't feel like I chose to be tempted to do that. I didn't choose that. I didn't choose this.
But if we, for example, if we continue to choose to immerse ourselves in different social media platforms or different newsreels or different conversations or even different groups of individuals that their primary message is fear, and we choose to keep going back to that because it's affirming or it's justifying our fear, it's justifying our reaction, because it's just feeding us more fear.
If we don't see it as fear, then we see it as finding comfort. You know, I'm going to my fear channel, because not because I'm recognizing fear. I do agree that there needs to be a step back for all of us in saying, okay, where am I getting my information? And is it feeding my fear or feeding my affection? That's a great question to ask. But in the heat of the moment, I don't think we're thinking of it that way. I think it's just, this comforts me. This makes me feel better about my life than that. And when you're trying to just mitigate fear without God, you're mostly almost always grabbing to some false comfort, some false idea, absolutely. Some false power, some false something. I had two people write me today. I know we're getting to the end of this, unfortunately. We may continue this next time. So if you got some questions or comments about all this, come at us, because we'll come back with the same thing again. But I had two people write me today really concerned about their relatives who are believing some things about either Christian nationalism. One was that Trump is still our president in God's eyes, and Biden's a usurper, and God's going to deal with him in some way. And they're wondering, I don't even know how to talk to my family anymore. I got a couple of those right back to back, right after lunch. And I sat down, I finished Micah the day before, so I just kind of reading to Nahum. So I spent a moment in the introduction to Nahum that Eugene Peterson has in The Message. Mm-hmm. And I read these words. The stage of history is large. Larger-than-life figures appear on the stage from time to time, swaggering about, brandishing weapons and money, terrorizing and bullying. These figures are not, as they suppose themselves to be, at the center of the stage. Not, in fact, anywhere near the stage. But they make a lot of noise and are able to call attention to themselves. They often manage to get a significant number of people watching and even admiring. Big nations, huge armies, important people. At any given moment, a few superpower nations and their rulers dominate the daily news. The danger is that the noise of these pretenders to power, I love that, the noise of these pretenders to power will distract us from what is going on quietly at the center of the stage in the person and action of God. God's characteristic way of working is in quietness and through prayer. That just fed so much of what I love about God, that we get caught up in Washington, D.C., what's going on there, what's going on in China, and those things are not insignificant, but that's not the center of the stage. The center of the stage is where God's doing his work. It's not going to be on the cover of the New York Times or the lead story in Fox News, but what God is doing in the world today, inviting people into greater freedom, love, and reality, that's where our eye, when we see that, then fear just vanishes. We don't need the fear. It doesn't serve us well. We don't need the arrogant, bullying defender of whatever it is that we think we're going to find comfort in. Or we don't need the protector to make the government what I think it ought to be against that people over there who are trying to destroy it. When we see what God is doing, and that's what I pray. To me, that's what the God journey is about, man. How do we see what God's doing today? Not just in the world, but in my life.
Yeah.
And where do I find comfort in his affection and his being on my side and his working for me, rather than trying to sort out all my fears and grab some false idea, some false comfort, some false notion to do it? And that's why I think when we put love in the world, when we keep learning to live loved and love people around us, that's the best way to set someone free from their fear. It's not to go, oh, you stupid person. You're just doing out of your amygdala, you fearful. No, that does no good at all.
No, that's just going to trigger them again, and the fight is going to be on.
But if we can find a way to just let love flow out of our life and help them find greater security in who God is, they'll be able to process life, I think, with greater wisdom and greater discernment. That's my hope.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.